Supporting WHYY, the Cooper Bone and Joint Institute, offering patients comprehensive osteoporosis care. From diagnosis and treatment to education and support groups, their specialists help patients keep their bones strong. Cooper's hospital program for those with fracture has been recognized for quality programming by the American Orthopedic Association. Offices are throughout South Jersey and in Newtown Square. For a consultation, cooperhealth.org/ortho or 1-800-8-COOPER.
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, a housing activist claims gentrification does not always have to be a dirty word. First, when a physical injury sends an adolescent to the emergency room, doctors say that can be the right time to check on that teen's emotional health. From WHYY's Health Desk, Tanya English reports.
Drexel University psychologist Guy Diamond says when you ask a teen, "Are you sad?" or "Do you feel like hurting yourself?" often young people prefer to answer those questions on the computer instead of face-to-face with a doctor or nurse.
Even though they know they're going to have to talk about it 10 minutes later.
At the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Diamond helped develop a computer-based screening tool that poses those questions during the ER visit. That data goes directly to a patient's digital health record. ER Dr. Joel Fine says the goal is to screen every child age 14 and older, not just patients showing signs of mental stress.
And so we're making this universal. They didn't want to be stigmatized. They didn't want to think that we were doing this on them, but not anyone else.
I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
Philadelphia Neighborhoods in Flux is the theme of a public forum tomorrow night, and attendees at WHYY's Civic Space will hear from residents and business owners about challenges and opportunities amid changing demographics. Offering historical perspective then, and joining me now with a preview is resident, activist, and documentary filmmaker Jamie Moffett. Jamie, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So when shall we start this historical timeline? Obviously, demographics change and evolve continuously in any city, including Philadelphia.
Sure. From my perspective, a lot of the research that I've been following has been along the Delaware River. And in the 1960s, the Society Hill Towers. The architect was I.M. Pei, who also designed the pyramid at the Louvre in Paris. Those three towers in 1964, they signified the beginning of a different kind of development in Philadelphia and cities like Philadelphia. In the late 70s and early 80s, Old City began to tick up as far as development was concerned. And then every 10 years or so, you'd notice that Northern Liberties and then Fishtown, and now as we're moving into Port Richmond, these sorts of development changes have been occurring pretty regularly, as you can almost kind of plot them on the map.
So I did cite you as, in part, activist, and talk about your work founding the Kensington Renewal Project.
Sure. So in my little studio in Kensington, as old barbershop, I turned into a production studio. While I was working on one of my other feature documentary films, I noticed a pretty significant uptick in violent crime. And I managed to put on my nerdy documentary film hat and ask a bunch of questions as to why that was happening in neighborhoods like Kensington.
Now, did you notice anecdotally or firsthand, or was it borne out by statistics?
Oh, the trouble was I had people yelling rock dope in front of my steps louder than the people who were on my phone. So, I mean, I had to go outside and say, "Please, sir, would you please stop yelling that you're selling heroin in front of my steps? I can't hear my client on the phone." So with that, I started to research the pieces of the puzzle, why that sort of stuff would be allowed in neighborhoods like Kensington. The stat that really stuck with me was that homeownership directly correlates to crime statistics. So the higher the rate of homeownership in a neighborhood, the lower the rate of crime. So my thought was to positively affect this by working towards acquiring vacant houses. We call them abandominiums. So acquiring abandominiums, rehabbing them with the intention to sell them to owner-occupied families.
The idea being if you are invested that way in your community, you have a vested interest in seeing it flourish. To what extent have you had success in that endeavor in the years since?
Well, I'm happy to say that we did sell one this year. The deeper goal is to identify long-term renters who have an interest in becoming homeowners. Philly is known as a city of neighborhoods, right? So if development or gentrification or the term, however you want to call it, if that is stretching that fabric in a way that that we as Philadelphians don't want to happen, we can see that now that we have enough of a view as to how development is moving, in my case, further north, we have enough time to positively make those changes so that as these tides rise, all boats can rise together.
But is it all boats? Jamie, you cite the importance of home ownership and now, though, speak to the tension between community-driven development and business interests, business development.
That's an excellent point. We've seen it in places like Point Breeze. I mean, the city council race is essentially a referendum on development. Bob Lupton is a developer in Atlanta, and he wrote a book and coined the term gentrification with justice, the idea that you can make a neighborhood more developed, healthier, safer, but equitable for all, so that long-term renters can become homeowners, folks that want to stay there can choose to do so and not be pushed out by big money and big developers coming in. And developers, in some case, are there for the profit, and they don't necessarily understand the fabric of the neighborhood and haven't spent enough time learning who their neighbors are and who they will be.
What are some neighborhoods that perhaps you are looking to who've had success in that regard that their example might be in part applicable to, say, Kensington?
Sure. I've been really excited by the success stories from the New Kensington CDC. They did a really great job with, for example, their home ownership program. It's a 12-month credit repair program that then escorts you into the mortgage process. Long-term renters who became homeowners, and I mean, these are folks like, I know a pastor who went through the process, and I mean, on a pastor's salary, there's no way you can afford, you know, a brand new Fishtown home, no way. But he lives there with his wife and two kids, and it's really remarkable. And I hope that we can take those kinds of stories and those kinds of best practices and say this can happen in other neighborhoods for other families.
Again, the title of tomorrow's Speakeasy Forum, Philadelphia Neighborhoods in Flux. And overall, would you describe that flux right now optimistically, or is it a stasis, or is it going downhill?
I feel positive about it. I do want to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to be a part of it, and as equally as we can make that so.
Jamie, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
My pleasure.
Jamie Moffett is a Philadelphia resident, documentary filmmaker. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at the Speakeasy Forum right here at WHYY's Civic Space, Philadelphia Neighborhoods in Flux. This Saturday night, the heavyweight championship of the world is on the line, and there's a chance a North Philadelphia boxer could bring it home. Undefeated Bryant Jennings will enter the ring at Madison Square Garden as an underdog, but he doesn't see himself that way, and neither do his former co-workers at the Federal Reserve Bank, as WHYY's Todd Bookman explains.
There are plenty of bankers at the Philadelphia Fed's 6th Street headquarters, but also lots of blue-collar guys like Harry Habina, a senior mechanic there, whose modest claim to fame is that he used to tell Bryant Jennings what to do.
Yeah, he was a junior mechanic, but yeah, he was always helpful because he's big. So if we need to lift the motor up, there's Brian, he's right there.
Habina and the other maintenance workers have had a front row seat for Jennings' climb up the rankings. They came out for his first fights as an amateur in 2009, then for bigger matches. Some even flew to Las Vegas to see their buddy in the ring. And all the while, Jennings kept his day job, becoming something of a folk hero around the place.
He never had any fear. I always asked him, I said, yeah, what's it feel like when you're coming down? You got to be scared, like stepping over, you know, through the ropes and all. And he goes, I don't feel it. He goes, I'm just focused on what I need to do. And I said, you're not scared. I said, I'd be so scared. He goes, nope. Nope, not at all.
At 19-0 and on the edge of boxing's biggest stage, Jennings finally quit the Fed last August after 10 years to focus full-time on training. But co-workers like Joe DiGiovanni are still quick with stories, like about the PB&J sandwiches he would wolf down at lunch.
We call him Jethro.
We call him Jethro because of the Beverly Hillbillies. Jethro, yeah. There, the way he would eat.
Right.
And that's the way Brian was, you know.
In the ring, the 30-year-old goes by another nickname.
From Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, USA, North Philly to be exact, the undefeated heavyweight contender, Brian. Bye-bye, Jenny!
It was a fast rise and took everyone by surprise, except, I think, Bryant Jennings.
This is John DeSanto, who runs the website PhillyBoxingHistory.com. He's tracked Jennings since his debut.
He's a guy who really believes in himself. You know, he's got great boxing skills, but this guy's a winner, and he's a believer.
Jennings is going to need that confidence, because the boxer he's up against hasn't lost in a decade. Ukrainian Vladimir Klitschko enters the fight with a 63-3 record, including 53 knockouts. His nickname? Dr. Steelhammer.
Down goes Bulev on another left hook, and it's a fifth-round KO win for Vladimir Klitschko.
On paper, everything suggests this is Klitschko's fight to lose. He's got more experience, he's taller, 20 pounds heavier. But DeSantos says Jennings' work ethic and athleticism could prove the difference.
He's going to have a great night. And it would help us all rooting for Jennings if Klitschko has not such a great night. But the thing is that boxing's unlike a lot of other sports because it can turn in one moment.
One lucky shot, somebody's legs buckle, that may be what decides this thing.
I see the fight and then the knockout, either me or him.
Brian Jennings is training in Houston right now, trying to avoid any hometown distractions. We caught up on his way home from the gym.
I understand this is a very tough fight. I understand this is the top, this is the pinnacle of the heavyweight division. And I'm fighting one of the best heavyweights in the last, you know, 2 decades. So I know what I'm up against, and I know what I have to do. I know how I have to prepare mentally and physically, and I'm ready for it. And this is my chance to take over the world.
Jennings says he kept his day job at the Fed for so long so that he wouldn't get, as he puts it, spoiled, even as his paydays in the ring grew. It'll be tough to stay out of the limelight if he pulls off the win. Even if he loses, Harry Habina would welcome him back to the Fed anytime.
We're all proud of him.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. We're all tight.
And they're all heading up to New York on Saturday to see their friend fight in person. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, 1 month after launching it, students and alumni from Swarthmore College have ended their sit-in demanding the college sell its investments in oil and gas companies. Students say they're ending their occupation of the administrative building hallway because the college's board of managers has agreed to take up fossil fuel divestment at its May meeting. They also say a faculty resolution signed last week requesting the college sell its oil and gas stocks helped them to decide to end the sit-in. Swarthmore's administration says the $1.9 billion endowment would generate $10 to $14 million less each year if fossil fuel investments were sold. 72 degrees, clouding up on Independence Mall. It's 6:18. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. A tornado watch in effect in our region until 10 this evening. The possibility of showers, thunderstorms accompanied by damaging winds and hail. Then gradual clearing overnight, low 53 degrees. Still ahead, a Philadelphia citywide event has every neighborhood looking up at the night sky.
We wanted to help people understand that no matter where you live in an urban environment, even though there's a lot of light at night, there's still plenty of great observing that can be done.
Newsworks Tonight looks aloft on WHYY.
Abington Friends School, a Quaker school for students age 3 through grade 12, supports WHYY. Abington Friends School's child-centered lower school program nurtures joy and love of learning both indoor and outdoor, including a nature playground. With math and language arts specialists in every classroom and a team of science, music, and art teachers, students are supported, challenged, and inspired. Abington Friends School. Registration for the April 25th open house at abingtonfriends.net.
Dance Celebration supports WHYY and presents the Dancer Athletes of Pylobolis and their gravity-defying, rule-breaking choreography. Seen previously at the Oscars and the Olympics, Pylobolis returns to Philadelphia with new works. Pylobolis, May 7th through 10th at the Annenberg Center. Details at 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org. 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org.
The John James Audubon Center at Mill Grove proudly supports WHYY and will host Picturing Mill Grove, Images of Today, Vision for Tomorrow, an exhibit of plein air works recently created at historic Mill Grove, Audubon, PA, on Friday, April 24th from 6 to 9 p.m. Mill Grove is the first American home of bird artist John James Audubon. In addition to the artwork, the public can enjoy refreshments and be among the first to see the architectural renderings of the new museum and visitor center due to open in 2017. More at johnjames.audubon.org.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Have you noticed the dearth of victory parades down Broad Street lately? Chris Cetullo has, and in this week's Center Square commentary, he offers a surprising nominee for which team will first remedy that lack.
In Monet, we trust. In Chip, Ruben, Ron, and Sam, not so much. Before a mayoral forum I attended last week, the organizers decided to have a little fun with a mock poll. The question was, which Philadelphia team do you expect will be the next to win a championship? Eagles, Flyers, Phillies, Sixers? Nah, losers all in this election. Garnering the most votes were Monet Davis's Taney Dragons, darlings of the last Little League World Series. And a child shall lead them, because the adults are not exactly doing a bang-up job. The Sixers and Flyers just concluded dreary seasons, missing the playoffs. At least Sam Hinkie's Sixers can say they were trying to fail to snare high draft picks. Ron Hextall is just the latest in a line of iconic Flyers to stumble as general manager. I feel confident in predicting Ruben Amaro's boys in the red pinstripes will not make the baseball playoffs. That'll leave Chip Kelly's Eagles as our only chance to avoid the first total postseason shutout year since 1994. Wasn't it just yesterday that Charlie Manuel was waving to cheering throngs from a truck bed on Broad Street on the way to Chase Utley dropping the most famous F-bomb in the city's history? On one level, yeah, it seems silly to suggest a sports team's performance should reflect or affect the status of a city of 1.5 million souls. Even if Ryan Howard can't hit anymore, that doesn't make the doctors at Fox Chase any less amazing, the Barns any less glimmering, or Fishtown any less of a hipster haven. But this is Philadelphia. Our spirits do rise and fall in tandem with how the boys in Midnight Green or in Orange and Black perform. The Phil's World Series win was part of the wave of good feeling that accompanied the opening of Michael Nutter's mayoral tenure, and their current sad sack ways tend to reinforce the gloomy vibe now emanating from City Hall. My vote on that poll might surprise. I think we're a long way from paradise, 3-4 years at least. But I suspect those tanking Sixers are the ones who will next take us there. Turning around a basketball team takes less time than a baseball rebuild. And the Sixers have stockpiled the needed chips. All the Phils have stockpiled is sore joints and killer contracts. The Flyers' futility is deeply ingrained, and I'm bearish on Chip Kelly's alleged genius. So here's a question. How many more years until Monet is eligible for that baseball draft? I'm Chris Cetullo.
Chris Cetullo is WHYY's Vice President for News and Civic Dialogue. You can find this and other commentaries at newsworks.org.
A musical composition about Pennsylvania's coal mining legacy has won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize in Music for its composer. Julia Wolfe's Anthracite Fields was premiered by the Mendelssohn Club and the Bang on a Can All-Stars in the Episcopal Cathedral in West Philadelphia. Wolfe grew up in Montgomeryville, Pennsylvania. She spoke last April with WHYY's Peter Crimmins.
I'm in this strange place where I'm writing things that are outside the box. I'm trying to take music someplace new. And so it's this weird melding of being close to home and going somewhere you've never been before.
The Pulitzer Committee called the work a powerful oratorio, evoking Pennsylvania coal mining life around the turn of the 20th century. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.